So at the beginning of 2012, relations between the United States and Iran were particularly frosty. The Iranian government had announced it didn't want US aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf any longer. It had sentenced to death a former Marine on charges of spying for the CIA. And according to some reports, it had begun a uranium enrichment program in an underground nuclear site. The United States, for its part, had imposed sweeping sanctions on Iran intended to hit its economy very hard indeed. And in early January that year then, the distinguished American-Israeli journalist Jeffrey Goldberg wrote an article evaluating these tensions between the two countries and particularly these sanctions which the United States had imposed. And in the article he included this paragraph. He said, "Republicans who still call Obama soft on Tehran are either delusional or cynical. His administration has moved a long way from engagement. In fact, it now appears to be moving inexorably toward war." 4 years down the line, that predicted conflict, of course, hasn't transpired. But it's a memorable turn of phrase, nonetheless, moving inexorably toward war. It's a line that many journalists and historians have used in all kinds of other contexts, going much further back than Goldberg's article. And it's a line which well describes the situation at the beginning of the book of Joshua. The Israelites here are moving inexorably toward war, toward the conquest of the land of Canaan. So in chapter 1, verse 2, God has commanded Israel's new leader, Joshua, "Arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them." In verse 11 of chapter 1, Joshua has commanded the Israelites as a whole, "Prepare your provisions, for within 3 days you are to pass over this Jordan to go in to take possession of the land." Chapter 1, verse 14, Joshua has there given specific instructions to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh to pass over armed before their brothers. And now, in the opening verse of chapter 2, things continue to hot up. The momentum gathers a bit more pace. The movement towards war intensifies. Joshua now actually sends men into the land of Canaan. Now, before we get too excited, these aren't fighting men, and there are only two of them. These are spies. Clearly, at this point, before things go any further, Joshua wants information. He wants intelligence. And it's with the mission of these two spies then into Canaan that the whole of Joshua chapter 2 is concerned. And we're going to be looking at that mission this evening, and I would like us to notice three things about it. So first of all then, it's a ridiculous mission. It's a ridiculous mission. So these spies then, whom Joshua sends, they are introduced to us in verse 1 simply as two men. Their names are not given to us there, nor at any subsequent point in the narrative. And perhaps that's as well for these two spies, that their anonymity is preserved, because they don't exactly cover themselves in glory here. This is not a dignified, competent, professional, well-executed spying mission which they carry out. No, it's bungled. It's inept. It's laughable. It's ridiculous. Let me show you what I mean. So, for one thing, we are told in verse 1 that they are sent secretly, as you would expect with a pre-conflict intelligence gathering activity like this. It's undercover, it's highly sensitive, it's a beneath the radar sort of mission. The Canaanites must not get wind of what these two spies are up to. Which makes verse 2 kind of embarrassing, doesn't it? And it was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." So much for the secrecy then. Within hours, probably less, of their arrival, everyone in Jericho, even the very king himself, knows that the spies are there. But then again, the commission they are given in verse 1, it's a very wide-ranging one. They are to view the land. That's what Joshua tells them. So they are to travel then the length and breadth of Canaan, scrutinizing its cities, its plains, its hills, its forests, its rivers, its borders. Yes, they are to especially focus on the city of Jericho, it's true, but they are to view the land. That's what Joshua says. That's the commission he gives them. Well, I think it's fair to say that that goes pear-shaped too. How far do they get? Well, they get as far as one house that's in the outer wall of Jericho, and that's it. In other words, they barely get into Jericho, actually, let alone into the rest of the land. The geographical dimensions of this mission are a pitiful fraction of what they were intended to be. Then again, there's the situation that we find these spies in when we come to verse 6. I said a moment ago they don't exactly cover themselves in glory. What they do get covered in verse 6, is flax. And to be covered in flax then is a fairly undignified position for anyone to find themselves in. Flax was a plant then. The fiber from inside of it was used to make linen. And in order to extract the fiber from inside of it, you had to soak the flax for quite some time and then dry it out. And that's probably why it was laid on Rahab's roof like this. It was drying out. Which means that it may well have been a fairly soggy and smelly covering for these two men. But if it's an undignified position for anyone to find themselves in, it's particularly humiliating for men who are supposed to be spies. We have that verb in both in verse 2 and verse 3, search out. So the spies are to search out the land. It's mentioned twice, but the Hebrew word there is dig. That's the literal word that we have. These men are diggers. Their role is to dig for information. But then on the other hand, this verb hid that we have in verse 6, he hid them with the stalks of flax, it's the literal Hebrew word buried. It's used of burying bodies elsewhere in the Old Testament. And so you see the embarrassing irony here. These men are supposed to be digging things up, and instead they're being buried here. Then again, there's the escape of these two men from Jericho. There are actually several laughable elements here. So we're told in verse 15 that they are let down by a rope. Now that sounds okay. But then notice that once they have been let down, they themselves refer in verse 18 to this scarlet cord. This scarlet cord. Clearly, it's a scarlet cord which they have to hand as they are speaking here. How do they have a scarlet cord to hand as they're speaking? Well, probably because it's the rope. The scarlet cord is the rope that they are being let down the wall on. And so they're still holding on to it as they speak in verse 18. Well, what then was this scarlet cord? Well, no one knows for sure, but the most likely suggestion is that it was some kind of scarf or sash belonging to Rahab. In other words, these two men are being lowered down the wall here, clinging on desperately to some kind of very glamorous, very feminine piece of material from a woman's wardrobe. It's not a very heroic sort of exit strategy. And then on top of that, they have the further discomfort of verse 16. By this point in the mission, these spies should now be striding back to the camp, to Joshua's camp, with an encyclopedic knowledge of the land and a well-developed plan as to how they're going to enter it and take it. They should be grandly telling the Israelites now where they must go and which routes they must take. Instead, what we see here in verse 16 is that they are helplessly dependent on the knowledge of this Canaanite woman. They are being meekly told by her where they must go and which routes they must take. And then on top of that, there's the fact that this whole conversation in verses 16 to 21 between Rahab and the spies, it seems to take place once the spies have been lowered down. So verse 15, we read, she let them down by a rope through the window. And then in verse 16, she said to them, ... So it seems like the conversation takes place once the spies have been let down. What's the big deal about that? Well, just this. The spies' remarks in verses 17 to 20, they sound, don't they, like the remarks of two men who have just been lowered down a wall on the end of a brightly coloured female garment, and they're desperately trying to recover their poise and sound all assertive. This business, you know, of sparing you and your family, Rahab, well, there are terms and conditions, you know, and if you're all in the house, that's fine. If you're not in the house, then we're not going to save you. And they're trying to kind of recover a bit of their pride, almost, it seems. And that's all well and good, except it's quite hard to pull that off convincingly if you're at ground level while the person you're talking to is in a window way above your head. I mean, in those circumstances, it's quite hard to maintain the upper hand in the conversation. I'm saying even the whole physical arrangement of this scene kind of undermines this assertive impression that the two men are desperately trying to create. And so then, I'm saying, in all these ways, the spy's mission is presented as a laughable, ridiculous affair. Why? Is this just the narrator wanting to entertain us? Well, of course not. He's making a point by presenting the story in this way. He's making it clear from the outset of this book that Israel's successful conquest of Canaan is not to be attributed to military brilliance and tactical sophistication and just a natural talent for conquering enemies on the part of the Israelites. I mean, we all agree, don't we, that theme becomes apparent in chapter 6 and the fall of Jericho. I mean, there's no military brilliance involved in the fall of Jericho. All the Israelites do, their entire contribution is just marching around blowing trumpets. That's all they do. So we all agree that in chapter 6, we have that theme. But I'm saying it's apparent actually before chapter 6. Even here in chapter 2, in the sheer incompetence of these Israelite spies. I mean, intelligence gathering like this, it's such a basic military activity. The war proper hasn't really begun at all when you just send out your spies, as Joshua is sending out his spies here. And so if Israel can't even do that effectively, if they can't even pull off a decent spying mission without all these scrapes and blunders, then they're a pretty hopeless case, really. And so it's clear already, before they've even crossed the Jordan, it's clear already that if Israel is going to successfully conquer the land of Canaan, it won't be anything to do with military brilliance, tactical sophistication, or a natural talent for conquering enemies. What will it be to do with then? God. Simple as that. The taking of a land by this people that can't even spy out a city, that can only be God's doing. That's the point the narrator is making. And it's a point that I think applies to us this evening, albeit very indirectly. We're, of course, in a very different sort of situation. We are people who are not called to conquer a land. But as disciples of Jesus Christ, we are called to all sorts of things. And we are people who perhaps are often tempted to think in all kinds of areas of our Christian discipleship, it all depends on me. It all depends on me. It all depends on me. But you see, Joshua 2 is saying to us, no. The battle is the Lord's, as we sang a few minutes ago. Or better still, in the language of 2 Corinthians 4:7, with which I began our service this evening, the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. That's what Joshua 2 is saying. Some of us this evening are parents, and we rightly want our children to grow up as ardent followers of Jesus Christ. And we can easily think, it all depends on me. It all depends on me. No, the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. Some of us are preachers, and we rightly want our sermons to penetrate the hearts of our hearers. And we can easily think, it all depends on me. It all depends on me. No, the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are members of churches, perhaps this one or other churches. We rightly want our churches to grow and surrounding communities to be turned upside down by the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we can easily think, it all depends on us. It all depends on us. No, the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. Now, of course, in all of those areas, we have responsibilities. I'm not saying for one moment, let's sit back and relax and do nothing. But I am saying, let's recapture this biblical vision of a great God who uses us, yes, but who doesn't need us or rely upon us, who isn't scuppered by our limitations and inadequacies. This God who can rout the Canaanites despite Israel's spies ending up plastered in soggy flax. This God who can cover the first century Roman world with new churches, despite the Apostle Paul being a fragile jar of clay. This God to whom, amidst our weaknesses, the surpassing power belongs. It's a ridiculous mission. Secondly, notice with me, it's a reassuring mission. It's a reassuring mission. So having said all that I've just been saying about these spies, we mustn't actually be too hard on them. Certainly they don't bring back from Jericho any of the kind of information that you would expect spies to bring back, anything that's militarily useful. But they do bring back some information. And you find it right at the end of our passage there in verse 24. They said to Joshua, truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us. Now this is information which they have gleaned from their conversation with Rahab. They're basically quoting her verbatim from verse 9. She says there, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. So the spies in verse 24 are just quoting what Rahab has said back there in verse 9. And strictly speaking, it's not new information for Joshua, actually. I mean, if you look back at chapter 1, verse 5, God has himself said to Joshua, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. So God has promised there to Joshua that the Canaanite peoples, they're just going to be swept aside by you. They're not going to be able to resist you. So verse 24 of chapter 2, now it's not new information really for Joshua. It's simply confirmation from within the land itself of what God has already intimated to Joshua anyway. It resembles, I think, another Old Testament scene. I'm thinking of one involving Gideon. Roughly the same period of Israel's history just a little bit later on. And remember how Gideon then was one of Israel's judges, and his task as Israel's judge was to defeat the Midianites, to lead Israel in the defeat of that people. And there he is, and he has his little army ready. It is a little army. It's been significantly reduced by God, you remember, from its original size. And just before the battle then, the Lord says to Gideon, look, if you're afraid, this is what you can do. Go to the Midianite camp and listen to what they're saying. And so Gideon takes his servant and he goes to the Midianite camp in the middle of the night. And immediately he overhears one Midianite telling another Midianite the dream that he's had. A cake of barley bread has rolled down the hill and flattened their tents. And the other Midianite interprets the dream immediately. And he says, that's Gideon, because Jehovah has given the Midianites into Gideon's hands. And again, strictly speaking, it's not new information for Gideon. The Lord had said to Gideon at the point of his commissioning that you will strike down the Midianites. You will defeat them. But again, and this is simply confirmation from within the Midianite camp of something God has already intimated to Gideon anyway. And so in both cases then, what we have is God reassuring his servants. In each case, God could have just given the original promise and left it at that. After all, God never breaks his promises. One promise is enough from God. And God could have just given Joshua and Gideon the one promise and left it at that. But in each case, God gives more. He confirms and underscores the promise for them. Is it not Psalm 103, verse 14, in action? Remember those great words there. He knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. You see, Joshua and Gideon are frail human beings, prone to doubts and fears. And God takes that into account. Hannah often has to tell me that when competing with the children at anything, I need to let them win more often than I tend to do. So I'm playing football with Fraser and get a bit carried away and roll back the years, doing all these slide tackles and things, and I forget that he's only 4 years old. God doesn't forget that Gideon and Joshua are small and weak. He remembers that they are dust, and he gives them these precious reassurances. And he remembers this evening that we are dust. God doesn't have unrealistic expectations of us. He's sensitive to our doubts and fears. That's why he gives us the Lord's Day, week after week after week, and preachers to tell us again and again and again about God and about the gospel and about our eternal future. He could just tell us those things once at the start of our Christian lives, but he doesn't. He tells us these things again and again and again. And in that way, he gently reassures us constantly and strengthens us. That's why he gives us a meal involving bread and wine, picturing the body and the blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. I mean, we've got the Gospels anyway. We've got the Passion narratives. But he gives us more. He gives us these physical emblems and symbols. And in that way, gently reassures us and strengthens us. What a God we have, don't we? A God who, although so devoid of any doubts and fears himself, nothing fazes him, yet is so patient and accommodating toward our doubts and fears, and who addresses those, and who provides us with such reassurances. It's a ridiculous mission. It's a reassuring mission. But then thirdly this evening, it's a rescue mission. It's a rescue mission. Because there's a surprise twist then, isn't there, in this narrative? Here are these spies and they're checking out this city because they're going to destroy it. That's the stark context of this spying mission. And the last thing you expect, therefore, is it turning into a rescue mission. But it does. I'm talking, of course, about this woman, Rahab, who in the course of this mission to a city that's about to be destroyed, in the course of this mission, she is assured of deliverance. And just a couple of things then that I want us to notice in this connection. First of all, it's a rescue within a rescue. It's a rescue within a rescue. It's important that we read Rahab's speech in verses 9 to 13 carefully. It ends with verses 12 and 13, where she says, "Please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father, mother, my brothers and sisters," and so on. And you could go away from Rahab's speech here then simply with the impression that she's clever, she's good at wheeling and dealing, she's done well here to strike this deal. Well, I've been kind to you, now you've got to be kind to me, that kind of thing. But we mustn't miss the climactic moment of this speech, which comes before that. It comes in verse 11, and we can easily miss it. And as I say, go away from the speech with the wrong impression. But look at what Rahab says there in verse 11, "As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." Now that is an extraordinary thing for a Canaanite woman to be saying, for this inhabitant of Jericho to be coming out with. It's not extraordinary that she should believe that Yahweh, the God of Israel, exists. She would have believed that thousands of gods existed. But here she's not simply saying, I know your God exists, is she? She's saying, your God is the true and only God. If he's the God of heaven and of earth, then that doesn't really leave any room for any other gods. I mean, the whole worldview of pagans in the ancient Near East was that you had gods for all the different parts of the created order, gods for the mountains and gods for the rivers, and gods for this country and that country. But if actually Yahweh is the God of heaven and earth, then you don't need any other. She seems to be saying here that your God is the one and only true and living God. It's no wonder that the writer to the Hebrews, in Hebrews 11 verse 31, attributes faith in the full biblical sense to this woman. So, yes, we have here the rescue of Rahab from a doomed city. But I'm saying that actually lies within a greater rescue. What we have here is the rescue of Rahab from her pagan unbelief. And just two things to say about that quickly. First of all, I think we can miss how remarkable that is because we don't always sufficiently appreciate the kind of city that Jericho is. I think sometimes we can feel a bit sorry for the people of Jericho, and we could think, here they are, just these nice, innocent people, just getting on with their lives, and then just because they have the misfortune of being in God's flight path, being in the one country that God has decided he's going to give to his people, they have to be wiped out. And we can feel a bit sorry for these people. We shouldn't feel sorry for them. You see, the narrator here, he's drawing deliberate parallels between this visit of the spies to Jericho and another visit to another city in the Old Testament, the visit to Sodom in Genesis chapter 19. In both cases, we have a pair of visitors, a pair of spies here, a pair of angels there in Genesis 19. In both cases, we have a host or hostess being pressurized to hand over the visitors to enemies at the door, but a host or hostess who doesn't cooperate with the enemies at the door. In both cases, the visitors encounter a sexually depraved city. The angels in Sodom, of course, the homosexual desires of the people of that city. Here, just the simple fact that the first house the spies come to, at the very edge of the city, presumably at the main entrance, the first house they come to is what? It's a brothel. It's like people come to Newcastle from all over the country for the nightlife. It seems people went to Jericho because it was a place of sexual liberation, a place where you could do what you wanted, a place where there were brothels even at the main entrance. It was that kind of a city. And then in both cases, the visitors offer deliverance to the host or hostess and members of their family. So we have these parallels, and it's saying to us then, Jericho is another Sodom. It's in that class. It's in that category. That's the kind of pagan unbelief then that we're talking about with Rahab. When we say that there's this rescuer for not only from a doomed city, but from pagan unbelief, we're not just talking about common or garden pagan unbelief. We're talking about the pagan unbelief of Jericho, which is itself another Sodom. And she's rescued from that. And she becomes a believer in the true and living God. What a wonderful thing. What an encouragement to us in our evangelism. As we look out on a society that is increasingly marked by pagan unbelief, we don't need to be hopeless and despairing and think nobody's going to respond to the gospel. If this woman from this city could be rescued from her pagan unbelief, so can the people around us today. Perhaps tonight you aren't a believer in Jesus Christ. Perhaps you feel somewhat drawn to the gospel, but you feel, well, I've just lived too bad a life. I'm too messed up. It's not for me. It's exactly for you. There is nobody too messed up for the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel is for Rahabs. The gospel is for those who are enmeshed in the most morally depraved pagan unbelief. The gospel is for sinners. You can come tonight to the God of Rahab. And the other thing in this connection to notice is that there's a moment of great tension in the narrative that we shouldn't miss. As the spies leave Jericho, they're very vulnerable, aren't they? Rahab has told them where to go. That's where they're going to go. Which means, of course, that Rahab could now, once they've gone, tell the authorities in Jericho where the spies are. She could tell the soldiers where to go after them. She knows where they're going to be for the next 2 or 3 days. And she could easily do that. That, and they're aware of that, aren't they? That's why they say in verse 20, if you tell this business of ours, that's what they're referring to. they're concerned that Rahab could inform on them once they're gone, and that in just a few hours' time they could have pursuers on their backs from Jericho. But in verse 21 then, Rahab makes a promise, doesn't she, that she won't do that. They say, if you tell this business of ours, we'll be guiltless. And she said, according to your words, so be it. She makes a promise. Now this is Rahab. She's a prostitute. Her whole life is built on making false promises of intimacy to people. It's just her second nature to be unfaithful. She's already told that lie back earlier in the chapter when the authorities came knocking on the door. She said, well, they've gone. I sent them away. And so as a reader, we get to verse 21, and okay, she's making a promise. And okay, she might be putting the scarlet cord in the window, just as the arrangement has dictated. She might be doing that now, but in a few hours' time, she might well pull back the scarlet cord, tell the police where the spies are. Can we really trust Rahab? It's a moment of great tension then. And then you come to chapter 6, and the Israelites come to Jericho, and the scarlet cord is there in the window, and she's kept her promise. It's perhaps the first time in her life she's ever kept a promise, ever been true to her word. The leopard has changed its spots. Because when God rescues a person to a new intellectual position, believing in him now as the one and only true God, he doesn't just rescue them in an intellectual way, but that is always accompanied by a moral dimension as well. And we're seeing that already with Rahab. For the first time, this inveterate liar is keeping her promises. It's a wonderful aspect, isn't it, of God's grace, that he rescues us not only to faith, but to a new character. So it's a rescue within a rescue. But I hope you're not going to be confused too much if I now make this further point. It's a rescue within a rescue within a rescue. Because even the rescue then of Rahab from her pagan unbelief, great though that is, even that's actually is set within a greater rescue still. Because Rahab, of course, resurfaces later in our Bibles. We've already mentioned Hebrews 11, she's in James, and she's also, of course, in Matthew chapter 1, where we read Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, and a whole list of names that Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and so on. What are these lists? What is this list of names? Well, it's a list that, of course, culminates in Matthew 1:16 with Jesus Christ. It's the family tree of Jesus. And so here, an even greater rescue is going on. God is rescuing millions of people from their sins. And he's at work in that way here in Joshua 2. And that's important for us to close with, because the rescue then of Rahab, we could look at it and say, well, it's lovely that she's rescued, but it's not right, it's not fair, it's not just. I mean, she's part of Jericho. She's one of these depraved Canaanites who deserves to be wiped out. She's a prostitute in Jericho. And okay, it's all very nice of God to rescue her, but it's not really right, surely. If he has pronounced his curse on this city, then surely she should be wiped out just like everybody else. But of course, this isn't just grace rescuing Rahab. It is grace. But it's just grace. It's righteous grace. Because Rahab is going to have a saviour from her own body, actually, from her own family tree. A saviour who will one day go to a cross outside Jerusalem and will pay for her sins. And will pay for her depravity. And will pay for all her years of prostitution and reckless, debauched living. So that it's not only gracious of God, it's fair, it's just, it's righteous of God to rescue and forgive and pardon this woman. And that then is the gospel of Jesus Christ for us tonight. There is a God who rescues sinners, and he does so in great grace, but he does so on the basis of a sacrifice at Calvary, where the sins of his people were paid for. Have you been rescued? Do you belong to God? Are you, like Rahab, a rescued person this evening? May God bless his word to us. Amen. We're going to close with hymn number 848.